This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Benedict Cumberbatch, stars in the new film, The Power of the Dog. The film was named one of the 10 best films of 2021 by the American Film Institute, appeared on many critics' 10 best lists, and won this year's Golden Globe for Best Movie Drama. Cumberbatch was named Best Actor for his performance in the film by the National Society of Film Critics and by film critics associations in New York, Boston, Chicago, Dallas-Fort Worth, and the San Francisco Bay Area. You can also see Cumberbatch now in Spider-Man No Way Home as Doctor Strange, and he's just completing work on the new Doctor Strange movie. Cumberbatch was nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in the film The Imitation Game, based on the story of Alan Turing, the mathematical genius who was instrumental in breaking the German Enigma code in World War II. Cumberbatch has played other real people like Stephen Hawking and Julian Assange. He's famous for his role as a contemporary version of Sherlock Holmes in the British TV series Sherlock. The Power of the Dog was directed by Jane Campion, adapted from the novel of the same name, and is set in 1925 in Montana. Cumberbatch plays Phil, who, along with his brother, played by Jesse Plemons, owns a cattle ranch. Phil is hyper-masculine. He's skilled at cutting the testicles off cattle, herding cattle, and braiding leather ropes. He rarely bathes. He's also a bully. He even insults his brother and calls him fatso. When they're taking the herd to market, they stop at an inn where they have dinner. They're served by a young man, the son of the woman who owns the inn. He has a clean white linen towel over one arm, the way you might see in a fancy restaurant, not a little inn in a tiny town. His manner and the linen make him seem effeminate to Phil. While the young man is serving the table where Phil, his brother, and the cowhands are seated, Phil picks up a paper flower from the handmade bouquet serving as the table's centerpiece and starts examining it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wonder what little lady made these.
Actually, I did, sir. My mother was a florist, so I made them to look like the ones in our garden.
Oh, well, do pardon me. They're just as real as possible. Now, gentlemen, look, see, that's what you do with the cloth.
It's really just for wine drips.
Oh, you got that, boys. Only for the drip. Now get us some food.
Phil's brother apologizes to the waiter's mother and soon marries her. When she moves to the ranch, Phil torments her, and when her son visits, Phil continues to mock and bully him. As the film progresses, we begin to get clues about what lies beneath Phil's exterior. Benedict Cumberbatch, congratulations on your performance and on the film. And I should mention, as we record this on Wednesday, January 12th, this morning, you were nominated for a SAG Award, the Screen Actors Guild Award, which is fantastic because that's like a jury of your peers. Those are actors voting, and they know their stuff. So congratulations. That must be a real honor for you.
Thanks so much, Terry. It really is, and thank you for having me. It is a fortuitous moment, and you're right. It's such a great validation of the work to have your peers who share this craft with you as their work to recognize it in this way. It's really, really humbling, a great honor.
So The Power of the Dog is a Western of sorts. I mean, it's set on a cattle ranch, and your character is he's a cowboy. So did growing up in England as you did American Westerns mean much to you? And did you study like the history of the American West or anything?
I mean, not really. No, it's about as far from my lived experience as you can imagine, which I guess is part of the enticement of wanting to take this character on and this milieu on. But no, I certainly didn't have a history of it. I had a little understanding of it from university, from studying cinema at that stage in my life. I guess the first inkling I had of a traditional Western it was the more sort of John Ford, tough man, the John Wayne. But also for me, I think where I really clicked into it was probably High Noon. I thought, here's deliverance from an unassuming hero in a way. And then the revisionist era of Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven began as well, which for me was at a very formative time in my cinema going experience. But it certainly wasn't a playground role play thing for me. And it wasn't something I grew up fantasizing about or knowing anything about.
Yeah. You said that Westerns, cowboys, didn't mean anything to you growing up because it was so far from your experience growing up in England. And you joked that to do this film, you had to go to dude school to prepare for the character, to learn both the Western things, but I think also to learn that style of like cowboy. So what are some of the things you had to learn and which was the most interesting for you?
I knew I'd get snapshots or feelings of who Phil was from my encounter, but with people who actually lived that life in Montana and who were graceful enough to let me into their world and educate me and give me an access to that extraordinary experience of working with animals. Extraordinary in the sense there's often a coordination between four species. There was one moment when we were driving cattle and there were horses, there were men, there was a silence at times but whistled or talked communication between dogs, and those four species working together was just something profoundly affecting. And realizing that and the connection to landscape was really as informative as any of the specifics of braiding, say, or whittling or whistling loudly, say, or the horse riding skills or any of the other kind of attributes this character has at his disposal, and of course the banjo playing, his musicality, but to marry the brutality of being able to master the hard work in that hard landscape and those hard times with this amazing delicacy and sensitivity, I thought that was at the core of his character.
In the novel and in the book, Phil rarely bathes. In the novel, it's specified he bathes once a month in the creek. And when the creek freezes over in the winter, well, then he just won't bathe. So in trying to really get with the character, you stop bathing for extended intervals while making the movie. I assume that was while making the movie. But like, that must have been a really icky experience for you. I mean, once you start to smell yourself and you realize other people are definitely smelling you and not acclimated to the smell like you are, that must have like been very uncomfortable and maybe even a little embarrassing.
In rehearsals, I did it for about a week before my family turned up in New Zealand where we were rehearsing and shooting the film. And I did it because I didn't want that to be something they had to endure. And I thought, you know, this is fine. This is about me getting used to it and Jane and, you know, maybe a couple of other people during the rehearsal period in that time. But then she'd say things like, oh, let's go and get some sushi. And I'd be like, oh, come on. Now I've got to walk out into the real world, not in character, possibly being recognized and carrying this kind of biohazard level heft of stink around with me. That's not fair.
I could see the tweets like Benedict Cumberbatch really smells.
It's enough to be self-conscious of it in any normal circumstance, let alone the heightened one I find myself in as someone recognized. But I think where it's essential and where it really helped was on filming days. I washed a lot more than Phil did, put it that way, but I would not have my clothes laundered. So I did carry his body odor with me. The minute I put those clothes on, I was him. I could smell him. And the minute they were off, I was me again. And I would clean myself up when I got home. But for the entire day, that was it. But I don't need to take my work home with me in order to provide authenticity for the moment to moment drama of a shoot. And I think it's really true. We wash ourselves a lot. We're very concerned about smelling neutral or pleasant. And this guy just didn't. And he lived in a time where people would smell.
You don't bring the character home with you, but you do keep the character when you're on set. You stay in character even when you're not filming.
I did for this one.
What does that... You don't always do it, but you did with this. What does that do for you? What's the advantage of that?
Well, I think what it does is if you're far away from who you are, it just gives you the ability to have a focus and a hook that's complete. You know, you're narrowing the chance for distraction so that your concentration can be more complete. It's also more a sublimation of the self and than it is method. Method is really pulling on your own psycho trauma and drama to facilitate the same in a character. And this is so far from my lived experience on every single level that, you know, a lot of this had to be manifested for me. Normally, I think my brain, either as a producer, which I'm doing now as well, or just as a curious filmmaker, kind of creeps into other people's business a bit. Not open in a intrusive negative way, but because I'm curious, so I'll lean into watching an actor's process, or I'll get interested in choices, or I'll wonder what the camera's doing or how that bit's going to be edited. I couldn't do that with this. I needed my concentration to be absolute. And normally being in character for me during the day, it comes and goes. I can switch it on and off, and that's fine. And the only thing I maintain, if it's a accent that's foreign to me, would be to stay in the character's voice. For Strange, I stay in his New York American dialect for as much of the day as I'm playing him. But for this, it needed something absolute. I needed to kind of blinker out my reality.
Jane Campion likes to explore different meanings of masculinity, and she certainly does that in this film. As we've talked about, your character seems to be a real bully and prides himself on, you know, this real macho. And the things that he does are very, like, you know, masculine things, like cattle herding, castrating cattle, wearing spurs and stomping around. And what are some of your insights to the extent that you can share them with an audience that includes many people who have not seen the film, what are some of your insights about what made him that way? Because when we talk about a certain type of, like, quote, toxic masculinity, it's always interesting to think about what's behind that.
What's really fascinating about bringing a character like Phil Burbank to life, you're really looking under the hood of it. You're examining the causality behind that toxic masculinity. Within that bracket, though, of behavior labeled toxic masculinity, I think there are genuine non-performative elements that he has just grown into being. I do believe that he is that ranch man. I do believe that he is that capable. He's a master of his crafts, whether it's the banjo or whether it's whittling or whether it's, I mean, the stuff that isn't the film, Iron Marguerite, taxidermy. He really is profoundly gifted. I think where it becomes toxic is where he has a need to protect things in a world and hate on a world potentially through that defensive protectiveness before it hates on him. And I mean, to talk about the landscape a bit, for me, that was just an absolute gift. Our production designer, Grant Major, built a really masterful set. I mean, it's an extraordinary piece of reality, where there was absolutely nothing. And that was integral to filming in New Zealand. There were 360 degrees of nothing, which in Montana, near where the film's actually located, it sadly isn't the case. But logistically, very difficult to film there. But for an actor to be supplanted in that landscape with Grant's set, I mean, everywhere I looked, I had Phil. I had him in the weather. I had him in the sound of the wind and the grass. I had him in the movement and the breath of the cattle, the hair playing on the horse's back, which is actually a detail in the film that Jane picks up on with Ari's cinematography. And I just felt utterly nourished by the placement of where we were shooting it. My big fear was once we got to a studio in Auckland, I'd be having to clink across a car park in spurs and furry chaps and just feeling ludicrous, like I'm at some kind of Comic-Con convention of Power of the Dog rather than anything as real as the lived experience on that set on location was. And then the pandemic happened and we stopped, and our dreams became supercharged as the collective consciousness had this massive shockwave sent across it. And we came back to the work not only with a renewed vigor and focus, but just amplification of gratitude to be able to work.
So, you know, at the same time you're in Power of the Dog, you're also in Spider-Man No Way Home, which is a movie in the Marvel Universe, and you played Doctor Strange. And I mean, you have your own Doctor Strange movies, and this is like you're a character in the Spider-Man film. You just finished the latest, or about to finish the latest Doctor Strange film. The Marvel Universe seems so different from, say, the Jane Campion universe. She directed Power of the Dog. The whole, like, for example, like you stayed in character when you did your role of Phil in the Power of the Dog, and you know you kept your accent. Now you could keep your accent when you're doing Doctor Strange because it's a New York accent, not a British accent. But I'm thinking how funny it would be if all of the characters in a Marvel Universe movie, all the superheroes, stayed in character while they're on set. I mean, that would just be kind of ridiculous.
That would make it officially the most exhausting job you could possibly do as an actor.
And damaging too, because you don't really have superpowers.
There's that as well. That, yeah, exactly. That could be pretty devastating to come out of. But imagine that lunch chat. No, it's true. It would be a very bizarre situation because mainly it's such a fragmented, piecemeal process making one of those films. I've watched incredible actors use an insane amount of skills on those sets to just be able to magically turn it on, be fresh with it, and be loose with what's one of the biggest sand pits in the world, and play, and never forget the art of acting as playfulness. But that takes a huge amount of ability. And to be able to shift it and create something connected and present when you're acting against so many elements that aren't there, when you're having to use your imagination, it is like being back in the bedroom again and just playing with characters that aren't seen, that we do from in our childhood. I think it's a very, very heightened skill.
You come from a really interesting family. Your parents were both actors in England on stage and screen.
Yes, they're still actors.
Are both actors. Yeah, okay, good. And your family tree includes a great-grandfather who was a diplomat and served as consul in Turkey and Lebanon, and a great-great-grandfather who was a British consul in Turkey and the Russian Empire, and a paternal grandfather who was a submarine officer in both World Wars and a prominent figure in London high society. At least that's what I've read. Hopefully that's all true. Did you feel connected to them, and did they feel connected to a larger history? I mean, like my grandparents were immigrants, so I have no roots past them on American soil. But you have these, deep roots in British history, and I don't know, how did that affect your perspective on who you were?
Yeah, it sounds very callous to say this, but not much, because I don't know enough about my family history, really. I've never taken a huge interest in it, because for me it's always been about a very close-knit circle of individuals. I don't come from a very, very big family. I never met either of my grandfathers. My grandmothers were of an age when I was young. My parents had me quite late. So my connection to my past, I learned I'm reminded as much about it, or made aware of it being present as much about it by the description that you just gave. It doesn't inform who I am. I feel that I kind of just started as me, and my parents' influence is the be-all and end-all as far as family goes. And I was an only child. And I think, I don't speak much about my private life, but obviously Sophie's my wife, and she comes from a much larger family, three of them children, I mean, two brothers. And that expansive extended family that's now part of my life is a very near experience for me, a wonderful thing as well, beautiful, inspiring, and supportive and loving thing. And hello to any of them listening. They're so large, I'm sure one of them is. There's so many of them. But I guess I lived the life of an only child, and you really do think you're the center of the universe. I mean, not in a sort of arrogant way, but just you don't know any different. So I'm only really learning now a little bit more about my family's history.
Your parents were both actors. Did you spend a lot of time backstage watching them when you were growing up?
I did a bit. I mean, I've got a very vivid memory of Mum walking from, you know, one of those very sort of ordinary flats of wood, decorated obviously on the other side for the audience as a room. And I remember her just being my mum, and then a beat of something happening to her, her opening the door and being completely someone else and walking out into the heat and the light. I don't know, it's just a very strong memory. I must have been, I don't know, around somewhere between the ages of 8 and 12, I'll say, and I was entranced by that moment of shift, that moment of transformation, and what that meant. How could she be my mum one minute and then suddenly be this other person for people watching her?
What made you want to act?
I think moments like that, pretty much from, I would say, 12 or so onwards. I mean, my parents, being actors, didn't want me to be a child actor. They wanted me to have a childhood free of being in the public eye, to have a natural, for want of a better term, development that's not exposed, I guess, that young. And they wanted me to have an education. They were very keen for me not to be an actor. They were very keen for me to be anything but an actor. And that's why they were working so hard to give me the opportunity to be a lawyer or a doctor or a teacher or whatever it might be, or someone in the diplomatic. I don't know what their ambitions for me were really, but I don't think they wanted me to be an actor. And then there was this one moment of blessing, which I think was the other real kind of gear change, and thinking, okay, right, I'm going to be able to do this as a living now that I've got my father's blessing. And I've been talking about it a lot recently, but it still remains a profoundly moving and humble thing to recount. My dad, basically, after playing Salieri in Amadeus, took me by the shoulders. This was at university, so I must have been around 20, and said, "You're better at this than I ever was or ever will be, and I can't wait to see what you're going to do with it as a career." And for a father to say that to his child, just enormous.
Yeah, I can imagine. I want to talk to you about when you took a year off from school. I think this was probably college, but I'm not sure. Maybe it was an in-between year. And you went to volunteer as an English teacher in a Tibetan monastery in Darjeeling, India. So how old were you when you did this?
I was 19.
Who was in your classes? Who were the monks in your classes?
The age range was about 35 years, I think. I had a man in his late 40s and a kid who was about 12. And I had in town, I had a sort of more sort of preschool crowd of Tibetan refugee children from that small village just outside of Darjeeling that I was at, called Sonada, which is one of those little towns along the Darjeeling railway train. If you look at the map of India, we were on the right-hand side, and it's that kind of finger that goes up towards Tibet and Bhutan and China and Bangladesh on the right.
How did it feel as a 19-year-old teaching English to Buddhist monks, especially the older ones who probably had a kind of depth of understanding of the world that, you know, a 19-year-old person
say
from
it.
London would probably not have, yeah?
It felt,
definitely did not have.
Yeah, I mean, the learning experience, as I constantly apologized to them for, felt very one-sided. I felt I was learning more than I could possibly impart to them for all those reasons you just stated, but not least because I'd only trained to be a teacher for about a month. Having said that, I did go for it. I built them a little kind of, well, classroom area and a blackboard and stuff that they didn't have from the previous volunteers. But I really, I think there is a sort of undeniable cultural exchange in the fact that they have access through me to an experience that's so utterly different from theirs. Of course, to us, theirs is far more exotic, but to them, a lot of it's very mundane. And, you know, the interactions were sort of comically overlapping. And then by the end, I really wanted to engage in the thing I'd been a spectator of. I took myself with another teacher. We met up with this lama in town. We were initiated into the teachings of Buddha and then given the opportunity to go on a retreat for 2 weeks. We started out in this small concrete room with about 30 other monks lining the walls. We did about 4 days of that. We're chanting this prayer that was in Tibetan, not knowing what we were chanting, and feeling a little bit, I felt at the time, like we were being indoctrinated blindly into something. And the Lama came back in and very wisely said, yeah, this is good for my students. You Westerners, you need to come with me. So we were then taught what we'd been doing. It was a clarifying ritual to purge us of lived experience, to create a more blank canvas, to then start receiving a meditation practice, which he then started to impart. And we meditated for hours, hour and a half, 2 hours at a time, and bit by bit would be drawn into focusing mainly through breath, different methodologies of concentration and being present, and what people now call mindfulness. And I remember the shifts in that time coming out of that experience, and just everything in the world seemed so alive. Everything seemed interconnected. It was a sort of psychedelic experience, actually. I felt a profound connectedness to some universal truth of what life and love and energy is. And it's sort of wordless. It's just a sensation. Profoundly moving, and stayed with me ever since. And I think sometimes when I'm in that flow state as an actor, or I experience a piece of art or work or physical experience in my life. I have three children, and what I will say about them is they're the most profound and beautiful creatures, as is their mother, and to be able to have those moments with them as well, it harks back to that kind of awakening in my teenage years.
I'm wondering if your experiences meditating and what you learned with the Lama have helped you through the pandemic. Speaking for myself, there's just so much to be anxious about right now. And there seems to be this like constant threat of, you know, of contagion, of, you know, of getting COVID. And it's gotten worse with Omicron.
Oh, completely. And I think like any kind of meditative practice, it's about drawing yourself back away from that anxiety and to a still point of focus. And that definitely has helped. But I've been just as caught up in the anxiety, I think, as you or anyone else, you know, as someone responsible.
Are you sure?
For my family. Well, I don't know you, because I don't know you, but I would imagine, Derry, that, you know, we've all, I think, had a kind of communal shock to the psyche on a massive global scale. You know, there's so much uncertainty in the world with things that used to be certain. Even approaching another human being, it's a risk. Thankfully, now that things are evolving, perhaps more just a risk of inconvenience than a life-threatening risk. But I was pretty far away from profound calm in those early moments of lockdown in New Zealand, where we were washing our groceries with detergent and washing them again to wash the detergent off, and leaving things outside that could be left outside and they need to be touched in case of surface contamination. I mean, it was... And I think remains still that sort of a new level of anxiety. But in that first moment, yeah, I was also harboring my parents as well as my family in New Zealand. So I was responsible for 2 8-year-olds, one of whom is a severe asthmatic. And they were supposed to travel back, having just visited us for what was supposed to be 3 weeks. And they ended up staying for 5 months because I just said, I can't put you on a plane now. I can't risk you getting this unknown threat. And especially for my father, who's the asthmatic, to risk his mortality. It's too precious. And so we held together as a family, and it was an extraordinary experience from that point of view alone, making this film. So, yeah, great things came out of it. We were very fortunate.
Yeah, well, good. You got through that early stage with feeling responsible for your family in New Zealand. I want to ask you about another life-changing experience. You were in South Africa, I think, shooting a film in 2005 when you and a couple of other people who were working on the film got kidnapped. How did that happen?
We were coming back from our first initiation to a paddy diving course. We'd done some paddy work with breathing underwater with regulators and oxygen tanks, air tanks rather, in a pool outside pre to going into the sea, which is just, you know, the preliminary preparation you make before going out to the sea. And I'd been pretty overworked and was anxious to get back that night rather than going Monday morning when filming was starting very early, because I think, you know, I thought I wanted to get home to have a good night's sleep. We were very cautious about that. The South African of the three of us was like, well, I don't think it's that safe to travel at night. I'm not so sure about that. And I kind of pushed it, not aggressively, but just in a way I obviously now regret. Our front right tire blew. We'd gone over some detritus in the road. We stopped to try and change the tire. We took all our luggage out, and that's when people approached us from the bush, the scrub land on the side of the road, and they surrounded us, told us to get back. Well, they first of all wanted all of our money and anything, any weapons we might have. We paid for our class in cash, so all we had were cards, which is part of why it lasted as long as it lasted. They then piled us back into the car. We drove off-road.
Did they put you in a trunk for a while?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think I was definitely seen as the problem. I was more talkative. I was definitely acting out and more nervous and frightened and panicking than the other two, who are far calmer and more adult. And I think because of that, they saw me as something to be contained. As they locked me in the boot with my hands tied behind my back, and I thought, this isn't good. I know this isn't going to end well. So I tried to argue my way out of that position. And eventually, after arguing with each other, they let me out. They took me up to the side of the road, and then the other two joined. By this stage, I'd kind of gone through every flush of panic, anxiety. And I was in this weird state of calm, and I felt very sort of accepting in that moment. I thought, okay, I'm going to be ringing my parents tonight or someone else's. It ended with them going away and coming back, going away, coming back, and we realized the car had been taken with our cards. They then wanted our PIN numbers, and it must have worked because they left us, and it went quiet for a long time, and we decided to make a move. We found a roadside pit stop for truck drivers, late night truck drivers, that was about, I don't know, maybe 400 yards away, outside a game reserve called Chashlui, and there was this cooperative of Zulu women whose artistry and work was sold, beaded bowls and incredible pieces of pottery and woodwork. And we told them our plight. We were in tears, and they were so, what was absolutely gobsmacking about it, and I'll never forget, was how humiliated they were. They said, this happens to us, we are poor, we have nothing, and they steal from us. There are bad people in this country. We're so sorry it happened to you in our country. We love our country, but we're so ashamed. And I remember the only man that was there was a security guard reaching down to give me a cup of tea, and I remember just bursting into tears, saying thank you to him. As I looked in his face, I realized I could look into a man's face and not be frightened, as I had been for the last 2.5 hours. To be grateful for the good in the world.
When you thought you were going to die and that they were going to kill you,
I did meditate. I started to breathe. I started to sort of go into a state of going acceptance, really. It was very strange. And I thought the profoundest realization is that that's a journey you take on your own.
Did you make any decisions about how you wanted to change your life if you survived?
I think the ongoing trauma from that, if it wasn't something that already existed in my character, it certainly ramped it up, was this need to live a life less ordinary, to sort of squeeze the drop out of every moment. I went back into that country. I finished the job. I also went traveling on my own afterwards around South Africa, but also maybe mainly Namibia. And when I got to a sort of adrenaline capital of Namibia called Swakopmund, and started jumping out of airplanes and going for trips in microlights and, you know, swimming with sharks and doing all sorts of crazy stuff that was about me controlling.
Like maybe going too far and...
Yeah, I mean, it was about, you know, I'd been forced to look at or reckon with my mortality, and this was about me doing that at my own pace. So it kind of makes sense when you see it like that. That was a big thing for me to get over, and I still work on that by dint of accidentally or subconsciously over-programming.
With all the risk-taking that you did afterwards, did you think that you behaved cowardly and therefore you wanted to prove to yourself that you weren't and take all these risks and survive?
I think that was definitely part of it. You're absolutely right. You know, I wasn't proud of my behavior that night. And I think also I wanted to understand what it is to not be forced to look over the edge, but to actually do it willingly, doing it to do it of my own volition, to have control over that, you know, to feel like I had control again. You know, that's the other thing when you're out of control and your behavior's out of control, to then sort of weirdly do something that seems mad to a lot of sane people. And, you know, I'm not, it's weird, I'm not a big thrill seeker. There are things I'm not interested in. I do not want to do a bungee jump. I have no interest in doing that at all, but I'd gladly jump out of an aeroplane again. I love it. I did it quite a few times after that time.
This is in a way where movies come into play. Like, there's so many scenes where somebody's on the verge of being killed, and they're such a wise guy. I mean, they're like wisecracking, and it's funny, and they're like totally brave, and they don't flinch. And like, real life is not that way. And like, quipping probably would not have been a very helpful response. And you've probably been in movies like that too. You know, like, you know, the Marvel movies. And so I'm wondering how you feel about that, you know, about like the quipping in the face of death.
I think it's fine in Marvel films. I think we need an escape from the mess and the peculiarities and the. It's a relief from that, and you know there is a lot of reality in that. There is some cowardice or mistakes or ill decisions and responsibility that has to be taken for those decisions in those films. I think, you know. But you're right, by and large, it's about standing up to something with a certainty and a sort of absolute power, which is not of the real world. And yeah, I mean, I play a sorcerer who throws magic at the problem and has great power from his insight into the mystic arts and how he can embody that and excavate that and externalize that through his hands and his ability to conjure things and use powers against adversity which aren't real, you know. It's fantasy. It's like comparing kitchen sink drama to Marvel, and yet at the same time to really hook in and feel, you know, the punch, but also feel the human element to these stories, you have to have actors who can bring in something authentic or something that in that moment feels of this world as well as of the world of fantasy. You have to care. If you humanize the problems in these gigantic films and do it with the same kind of mess and humor as our normal facility has as human beings, then you're kind of in as an audience because you can relate. And then you can maybe forgive the, and just marvel at, no pun intended, the kind of more heightened nature of fantasy.
Well put. You became so famous in England and here playing Sherlock Holmes, a contemporary Sherlock Holmes on the series Sherlock. What was it like for you to first experience that level of fame? How did it compare to what you thought fame would be like?
I don't think I really knew what fame would be like beyond my mum being recognised in the supermarket every now and again. But I was not prepared for it. Nothing prepares you for it. There's no school or learning to be done there. It's just one of those kind of things that when it happens, you have to kind of negotiate. And I still find myself doing that day to day with the shifting circumstances of my life and my visibility, recognizability or not. And it's I just remember that particular night when Sherlock dropped, that there is still a live audience. The water cooler moment was instantaneous. It was very early on in the days of Twitter, and Twitter just sort of blew up, and I was trending, and I thought, what the hell does trending mean? I know what trends are. I used to, you know, have yo-yos and aerobies and skateboards or whatever at school. That's a trend. But, and you know, so it was just a new language and a new way of receiving feedback, and it was immediate and sort of to the point that I expected after watching it at the producer and director's house, a writer's house, sorry, Mark Gatiss was there with me at Sue Virtue and Steve Moffat's house, who collaborated and created and produced and co-wrote the show. I expected to walk out into the street and for sort of journalists to be abseiling out of helicopters and everyone to be coming out their front doors going, that was amazing, because it was so hot online, you know, and yet you go out and it's just a cold night and get in a cab and go home. And then slowly things began to change. I remember stepping out of a hair appointment when I got my hair dyed and cut just before the second series was shot. And it was like the whole street came to a standstill, but suddenly like, oh, Sherlock. And then it just, you know, was very bizarre. And I remember promoting Star Trek and turning up to Tokyo and the airport there. It was just crazy. They were like, you know, it was like 30 people deep, screaming fans, all with artwork and placards and chanting. And I tried to normalize it by talking to them, but I looked like Pink Floyd, you know, in this massive arena. And they said they haven't had this kind of hysteria since the Beatles. And then Marvel going, oh, don't worry, we don't need to worry about you. We've got Chris Hemsworth, you know, and Robert Downey Jr. And then they took me to Nepal, and within 3 days we were being mobbed by hundreds of people in Durban Square. I actually had to call it with security once we were in a car and we were surrounded by people and the car was rocking. I went, we're not moving, so I'm going to get out and we can make a run for it. I can explain to the people I have to go, I have to work, and then get to somewhere where I can actually address people and say thank you and calm it down a bit. But my you know, the ability to be able to talk to large groups of people, that's a wonderful thing. The sort of platform it gives you for causes and concerns, and just to be able to talk and just communicate with people who've connected to the work is fantastic. You know, the ever-shrinking island of privacy is an odd thing to deal with. And, you know, the advent of the mobile phone means everyone's a walking publisher. So I get a little bit shirty with when my family's around, for certain. I'm very protective of them. That's when I become a little alpha male. But yeah, it's very odd to walk into a room and know that people know you and you don't know anybody in that room, or restaurant, or whatever it might be. I'm still getting to grips with that, because ultimately our job as actors is to observe and replicate and inhabit human behavior. And to do that, you need to sit amongst your subjects. And it's hard to do that anonymously when you get known. It's really back to front. You become the observer becomes the observed. And that shift is still tricky.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Benedict Cumberbatch stars in the new film, The Power of the Dog. You can also see him in Spider-Man No Way Home as Doctor Strange. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, our guest will be New York Times reporter Thomas Gibbons Neff, who has been covering Afghanistan. He first went there when he was serving in the Marines. He recently wrote about sitting down with a now high-level Taliban commander who in 2010 led a band of Taliban in a battle against the company of Marines in which Gibbons Neff was serving as a corporal. They had tried to kill each other in that battle. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Sam Brigger. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. Teresa Madden directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.